The following teaching is part 7 in a 20-part series by Dr. Ken Boa titled, Answering the Tough Questions About Life and God.
Read a book just last week called The Faith of the Fatherless by a psychologist named Paul Vitz. And Paul Vitz, I've met him. He teaches at New York University, which was one of my schools. And he is an interesting fellow because he grew up and became an atheist, and he was an atheist, I think, until he was 38 years old, and then describes the journey that he took in the process of coming ultimately to faith in Christ, and what that looks like, and how he eventually joined the Catholic Church. So it's a remarkable journey of discovery and of faith, and Vitz himself develops this book based upon a thesis that he calls the defective father hypothesis. And we're going to be talking about that, basically. We're going to be looking at an argument that has often been raised. You can see these questions are really the basic issues that people will raise. They're things that are surfaced when people are thinking through the tough objections. And this is a common one. Like, isn't Christianity, like all religions, just a crutch for people who are emotionally weak? Or don't people just create an image of God just to cope with the unknown? That sort of thing? That religions are made basically a projection of God? And so they talk about the idea that there's just a psychology of theism. And I'll be arguing when I discuss Vitz's book in just a minute, there's also a psychology of atheism, and that this is a sword that cuts both ways. That there are reasons why people can become theists and reasons why they become atheists. We'll talk about that as well. But the bottom line with this question, the essential issue here when we're looking at isn't Christianity just a psychological crutch, is whether it is simply based on subjective feelings and wishes rather than objective facts. And if that's the case, then we have a thing that really has no objective data to substantiate any conclusion that we could reach. And if that's all it is merely psychological, that would be a problem. Or, second option, it could be based on objective facts, not merely subjective feelings and wishes, and we could see how those subjective components, though, fit in the case. Now, I'd say that either it's one or the other, and if we say it's merely based upon feelings, desires, beliefs that people would like to be true, then that really removes it from the realm of inquiry. It removes it from the sphere of investigation, and you cannot really examine it as such. But if, on the other hand, it can be something that has an objective foundation, then subjective experience can be have a confirmatory evidential support. So let's take a look at the first objection, the first component then. Christianity is subjective, and I say right away that religion can be a crutch. And Christianity is often caricatured as a psychological mechanism. The fact is, crutch has pretty negative views, doesn't it? There's a negative association with that. What do you think of when you think of a crutch? You're broken, you're weak, it's a temporary measure, it's a stopgap, it really helps you lurch through life, but you're not going to do it very successfully. You see that idea? It's not a cure. It's just something that you use to hobble along in life. That's what often is evoked when people raise this particular issue. You could say it's a supply of aid or assistance as well, but always, whatever it is, even if it's neutral, it leaves something to be desired. There's always something that can kind of conjures up the image of something clumsy, some kind of a device to help you move through life, but not in an effective way. It could be a help, but it's certainly far from a solution to the problem. So this is the image that's often conjured in this. And according to this view, then, a religious person operates in this very way. They conjure up something, and it helps them kind of make it through life. They kind of make their way through. They want meaning and purpose, and they have a quest for this, and so therefore it helps them overcome their weaknesses and meet their need. And certainly there's all sorts of variations of this view. Karl Marx in Das Kapital kind of put an economic spin on the whole dynamic there, and he said essentially that it's the bourgeoisie that are using religion to kind of oppress the proletariat. And the idea here is they're kind of keeping them in their place by giving them hope of heaven in the future. Pie in the sky by and by. So the idea would be that religion would be the opiate of the people. It's just something. If you can use religion and give them that, then you can impress them in the present because they always have the idea that there'd be something in the future. Do you see how that works? So and putting an economic spin then, you can say that religion is used in this way. And again, one can say that religion can, or any truth can be distorted, but it doesn't have to be this way. For his view, then, the upper classes are using it to keep the lower classes in their place and keeping them from revolting. That's pretty much the idea there. Now, Freud and others developed a much different tack. Ludwig Feuerbach wrote a book about the essence of Christianity, and Feuerbach was basically speaking about how religion is a projection into the heavens of human attributes, a God figure. And Sigmund Freud picked up on this and pretty much took Feuerbach's thesis and embraced it for himself. And Freud's book, Totem and Taboo, and also The Future of an Illusion, talk about how religion merely takes a father figure and basically kind of projects it and gives us the illusion of control. You can have a God figure up there that you can placate, that you can appeal to. So it helps you deal with these otherwise uncontrollable forces in nature that you couldn't do a thing about. By personifying the forces and by making them manageable, then you can find ways of placating them and getting them to do what you'd want them to do. Do you see how the theory works there? And although Freud admitted, though, that this really wasn't something that he developed from any experimental evidence, it's just his own personal theory, and he really didn't connect it with his own thesis, although he said it was the Oedipus complex and so forth, that the father is the figure that the child ultimately wants to kill so they can have the mother, this sort of idea, and Oedipus Rex and so forth, the Greek notions. And so a lot of these things were thrown into the batch. I'll make a few comments about that in just a moment. But right now, let me say this much. I have to agree that religion can and has been used in some very illegitimate manners. I mean, it doesn't take much evidence to go on the television and kind of do a spin on the channels and see what's on there. Some scary stuff that's on there. Really bizarre things. Things just when you thought that they couldn't top it, there is something even worse. And I think about, you know, Tammy Faye's there, and then now there's someone who's even more. She makes Tammy look. I'm not using any names here, but you know, it makes Madame Pompadour look very modest here. We're talking about strange things too on these public access channels and these religion channels. People hollering and bellowing and screaming and ranting and raving, wearing I think some of the most bizarre outfits humans have ever conceived of as well, and doing some very strange things in association with this. And generally, you look at the crowd there. It's always interesting to look at the crowd. You know, when they pan over the people there. And generally speaking, what do you find in those audiences? You find folks often who have no other hope. And this is their last hope. And basically, these are folks up there who are saying, look, if you give to my ministry, you got the blessings plan, you see. And ultimately, you too will be benefited in this way, you see. You too will look and you can dress the way you want and you can have. It's just a matter of faith. And so we see a great deal of exploitation done in the name of Christianity. Let me be frank with you, if that was my exposure to Christianity, I'd blow the thing off for sure. In fact, I have enough problems of my own. Do I need this grief? You see the problem? So, yes, there are some horrible associations, and let me also stress that there are a number of people who have had horrible experiences with religion in their backgrounds that have made them bitter about any concept of God. Relationships with their father that Witz will talk about, we'll see in this book that he mentions here. Those kinds of processes, horrible experiences with legalistic kinds of experiences with churches and so forth that are binding with churches and schools and other experiences. In fact, there are a number of people who are very interested in various religious courses and who take great pleasure in trying to disabuse these benighted souls who have bought into fundamentalist expressions, you see, and it's their mission in life now to enlighten them by showing them it's a bunch of hooey. And there are some of the cases, though, I've discovered that they protest too much. There are some people who are so addicted to hating the scriptures who have actually succumbed to a syndrome that I call PFS. That's called post-fundamental syndrome. That's what I mean by PFS. It's a terrible disease. People who've been raised in fundamentalist homes have a great deal of emotional baggage of a negative sort that's associated with anything that seems or smacks of religion. And people who suffer from post-fundamental syndrome actually go almost the opposite end of the spectrum there. That they're actually, there's a sort of a, they cannot get it out of their minds. They keep going back to that deal, you see. So that can be an experience that people have as well. Well, let me make a few comments about this whole shaky crutch theory and go from there. So I say that, first of all, it's good to admit that religion can be a crutch. That's why I say it can be a crutch, and Christianity is often caricatured as a psychological mechanism. But then there are several objections that are specific objections that people have used. I will say this, the fact that religion can be a crutch doesn't actually mean that it always is. So the first of these objections that we have is that of precondition. And we're going to be talking just a short word about that. It's based, this particular objection, on two false assumptions. The first assumption about preconditioning. In other words, you're a Christian because that's how you were raised. The weakness in that particular assumption is that it envisions that all Christians were raised in a Christian environment. If you check around, that's simply not the case. A survey of Christians would indicate that many people came from homes that were religiously hostile or neutral environments. So that wouldn't account for it. Preconditioning certainly by itself would not account for it. Or a second false assumption, that if a person is preconditioned to believe something, that belief must itself be wrong. This is the assumption that's made. And let me stress something that's very important. The occasion of a belief is independent of its validity. Let me say that again. The occasion of a belief is independent of its validity. If you come to embrace a belief about whatever it happens to be, whether the occasion is on a drug trip or whether it's in a philosophy course, that the occasion has little to do with the validity of the belief itself. The occasion may be crazy and nutty, but the belief itself could be right or wrong. It's the issue is not how you came to that belief. Now, most of us were conditioned, let's say, when we were younger, to believe in Santa Claus. Were we not? Most of us were. And I remember my experience was that I was an ardent believer in Santa Claus till I think I was about 5 years old. Then I caught on, but I didn't want to let on that I caught on. And the reason for it is because I knew that this was something I don't want to let go. This is a good illusion to maintain. And I'll play along with this. It got pretty obvious when Santa would always sign the notes in my father's handwriting. Certain things like that. He didn't make much of an effort to disguise this. And so we'd play the game. Well, you know why I did this, of course, because I got twice as many presents. Because, you see, Mom and Dad can't be outdone by Santa Claus, after all. So I play along with this. Oh, until I'm about 23. I would have done it. But it comes a point where you have to kind of give it up and so forth. I don't know how old I really was, but I pushed it for all it was worth, milked that thing for all it was worth. Now, it turns out that preconditioning was wrong. I still remember, too. I remember as a little boy, I think I was like 3, I was a little older than that. I think I was about actually 7 or 8 because my teeth started falling out, and I remember the tooth fairy. Remember that? In my time, the tooth fairy was a good deal cheaper than it was when I had a function as the tooth fairy later on for my daughter. The prices went up substantially, you know. none of this nickel or none of this dime or quarter stuff here. I want to see green greenback there under the pillow, you know, right. That sort of mindset. So prices went up pretty quickly there with the tooth fairy, you know. But I had a game there where my daughter and I, we played this game. I'd actually kind of fly in there and she'd pretend to be asleep and she'd know when the tooth fairy was going to come. So I did this elaborate thing and I'd pretend that I'm trying to not disturb her. Of course, I'd throw her all over the bed and she's giggling and squealing with delight as I put the money under the pillow and do this whole. So it was a great game that we had. She'd squeal with pleasure when the tooth fairy came. But, you know, the time comes when Santa disappears, you see, and you realize you were sort of preconditioned to buy into that. Well, the same thing is true with a number of things. My parents also preconditioned me about other things, namely, keep your hand off the stovetop.
Yeah.
Fire is consistently hot. And I found this out. That, you know, you touch that thing every time. There's a commercial I saw not long ago. There's a guy, you know the one I'm talking about? The guy touches and burns his hand and goes, what? And then touches it again. And he keeps doing it. Nobody, something about not learning, not getting the point, something like that. Yeah. But the point is, it's mighty consistent, is it not? Well, let me tell you, that preconditioning was in fact correct. So the issue of preconditioning has very little to do with whether the thing is right or wrong, you see. You can be preconditioned to buy into something that's true or something that's fallacious. So you can't use that. It doesn't validate or invalidate a position. You have to investigate the validity of the thing itself. Which brings me then, so my point here was this, that preconditioning, many Christians were not raised, as I said, and preconditioning does not make a position true or false. But what about a belief in emotions? And a lot of people make the objection that belief in emotions, you see, just because you have a belief in an emotion, that doesn't determine truth, and therefore your beliefs aren't really valid. You might have them, and those, I'm happy for you. You've all heard that phrase, I'm happy for you. You know, that I'm glad it gives you peace and comfort. Basically, it's like a bit of a dismissal, isn't it? You see? Maybe that's true for you, but it's not true for me. The idea here is I'm glad it gives you peace, and if it helps you, that's fine. What they're saying, it has no objective validity whatsoever. All it is just something you've cogitated to give you the warm fuzzies. But it really doesn't help you much. And I'm suggesting here that really, a thing is true or false not because I believe it to be true or false. I might believe a thing that's false to be true, or I might believe a thing that's true to be false. So the beliefs and emotions don't determine truth, but because I have beliefs doesn't mean that they're wrong, just because they're beliefs. Or because I have emotions, it doesn't mean that they're illegitimate. So what I'm suggesting here is that one's belief in something doesn't have much to do with that, but whether belief or lack of belief. I'll give you an example about gravity. I might decide that I believe, after experimenting and so forth, I decide to believe that every time I throw up a ball, it's going to come down again. And sure enough, every time I throw it up, it does come down. Now, my belief has very little bearing on the fact that that ball comes down. It's gravity that'll do that. And it'll do it pretty consistently, whether I believe it or not. Similarly, I might decide that I'm Superman, you know, and jump out the window, as some people did, you know. Some people actually did. On acid trips, there was a guy who decided he could fly. Well, he found out otherwise. But the fact is, you jump out the window, you're convinced you can fly. Your belief has very little bearing on the fact that that's not going to hold you in the air. Although, you remember the cartoons, they would do this? Remember, like, the road runner, and he'd run off the cliff, and as long as he wasn't aware that he was midair, he was okay. Only problem he had was when he became aware and looked around, then he'd fall. Kind of interesting, isn't it? And that'd be fun if that were true. Although I like to point out the fact that it actually happened once. It actually happened on the Sea of Galilee. You see? He really was walking on water until he became focused on the fact that he was walking on water and he got his eyes off Jesus. Then he sunk, kind of. So it really did happen in a way. The point here is that it has very little to do with that, your belief in gravity and so forth. Or take the example of a bacterial infection. Somebody has a bacterial infection and they feel ill. Suppose you gave them a pretty strong dose of morphine. They would feel a great deal better and possibly believe that they were well because the symptoms are now being covered up. But actually, They're not any better than they were before. They just feel great at the time. Or suppose instead I give that same person penicillin and it deals with that infection. Now, initially, they don't feel any better, you see. So they may believe that they're not being helped at all, when actually that's the beginning of their cure. So the first person believes that they're well when they're not, and the second person believes they're sick when actually they're getting better. You see how that works? Again, it's not your subjective experience by itself that determines the validity of something. There's got to be something more than that. And I would stress then that your belief is only as valid as the object in which it's placed, but that everybody does have beliefs. You can't avoid belief systems and structures. Everybody has fundamental worldview assumptions about life, about who we are, where we came from, why we're here, and where we're going. And you cannot remove yourself from that and do something the opposite, to take a famous book title, On the Road. You know, remember the Kerouac novel there? We're all on the road. You can't take yourself off the road and have some objective perch where you look at all humans below. You're one of them, whether you like it or not, and you cannot not have a belief structure. So the real issue is to examine that and to see if it's worth holding on to. Just that whole idea, the unexamined faith is not worth believing, just like the unexamined life is not worth living. That's that sort of notion. So you have that objection there. So I say then that these don't determine truth, but Christianity appeals to the historical person and work of Christ, not to subjective belief and emotions. And we talked about the resurrection as a historically validated event the last time we were together. The third of these objections is that experience doesn't determine truth. And so what I would say here is that your experience may confirm some truth, but it doesn't determine the truth. I might have an IQ, give someone an IQ test, and you give this individual an IQ test, and it shows that they are very, very high. They have a IQ of, let's say, 150. Well, the IQ test doesn't make them that intelligent. It just shows that. It confirms the intelligence, but it doesn't cause it. You see the idea here? It can confirm, but it doesn't create. So the real question that you have to surface is always the following. Is there any objective validity to the preconditioning, the beliefs, the emotions? Is there any objective validity to these things? And that's where it comes down to a stronger position. As I said before, though, before you go on to the second component here and delving into whether Christianity has any objective reality, you do well to sometimes turn the tables and reflect on the other side of the coin. The fact is, there is no dispute that we, as humans, have a tremendous power to create all kinds, through our imagination, of fantastic systems. We've developed all sorts of images, gods and goddesses and theories and full-blown religious systems. And you have to admit as well that people can find in religion a great deal of consolation. It can be an important source of comfort and encouragement to them, whether the thing is true or false. People are often attracted to religion by emotional needs isn't in dispute either. I'm not denying that. And that religion has been used countless times in histories as a means of exploitation and oppression. I'm not denying that as well. What I am saying is that the same thing can be said for atheism or anything else. And that's where I would go from this. Gordon Allport, in his book, The Individual and His Religion, had an interesting incident that occurred. He was a Harvard psychologist. And as he wrote, a reckless young student who had a smattering of psychology, always dangerous, by the way, to have a little bit of knowledge. Remember how that works in college. You know more in college than you'll ever know again. This student once attacked Archbishop Temple, the great Archbishop of Canterbury, earlier in the century. With this accusation, you only believe what you believe because of your upbringing. That's what the accusation was by this student. The Archbishop promptly dispatched him with this reply. I like this. He says, you only believe that I believe what I believe because of my early upbringing, because of your early upbringing. Let me say that one again. You want to get that one, okay? So his answer was, you only believe that I believe what I believe because of my upbringing, because of your early upbringing. In other words, it's your earlier condition that makes you believe that it's my earlier precondition that made me believe. You see how that goes? What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Yeah. It cuts both ways, you see. As soon as you talk about preconditioning, how are you exempted? What gave you some special dispensation to be exempted from the human race and what we're going through? So it's an interesting point that you have to realize this can cut in both ways. I alluded earlier to Paul Witz's recent book, The Faith of the Fatherless, and it's a very interesting thesis that he develops in this book. Essentially, he looks at atheists and their fathers, and he looks at theists and their fathers, and it's pretty illuminating. What he does, he looks for the last prominent, not just your run-of-the-mill atheist, but really influential figures that are arguably substantial contributors to that whole issue and that discussion, that dialogue for the last 300 years. And then he looks at, for example, a variety of sources of atheism. And even referring to Freud, making the simple and easily understandable claim that once a child or youth is disappointed in or loses respect for his earthly father, belief in a heavenly father becomes impossible. I wouldn't go that far in saying impossible, but there can be, a person can be predisposed more toward or away by virtue of those experiences. There are, of course, in many ways a father can lose his authority or seriously disappoint his child. He can be absent through death or abandonment. If a father, for example, dies when a child is, say, between the ages of 2 and 5 critical years, because it's during those years that they begin to, or should begin, to bond with the father. The matriarchal bonding takes place up until the age of 2, but then the bonding with the father is supposed to take place, and by the way, your personality is largely shaped by the time you're 6. So there's a profound impact when your dad dies, and you're between in the area of the range of 2 to 5. And by the way, the child interprets that as abandonment. They interpret that as something that the father chose or elected to do. This is just how they perceive it. He can be absent through death or abandonment. He can be present, but obviously weak, cowardly, and unworthy of respect, even if he is otherwise pleasant or nice. Or he can be present, but physically, sexually, or psychologically abusive. He says, I will call these proposed determinants of atheism taken together the defective father hypothesis, and will seek evidence for it in the lives of prominent atheists, for it was in reading their biographies that this interpretation first occurred to me. Some of the atheists that he uses, for example, ones with dead fathers, and in every case these are people whose dads died around that period of time that I just mentioned, Friedrich Nietzsche, David Hume, Bertrand Russell, Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, Arthur Schopenhauer. All of whom lost their dads around that period of time in those formative years. Then there were those who had abusive and weak fathers, Thomas Hobbes, Voltaire, for example. I'm just mentioning a few. Ludwig Feuerbach, we mentioned him, Samuel Butler, Sigmund Freud, H.G. Wells. And there are it's remarkable how well the thesis goes. But then he says, now you might suppose that this is just happenstance or because of the culture, but I have a control group. My control group are theists who were equally prominent who lived in the same period of time. And if I can demonstrate that these theists, through biography, we're not making up this stuff, this is based upon biographical material that's available to anyone, had a radically different, consistently different experience, it would support my thesis. So he looks at theists like Blaise Pascal, George Berkeley, Joseph Butler, Thomas Reed, Edmund Burke, Moses Mendelssohn, who was the father, the grandfather, Felix Mendelssohn, the composer, William Paley, William Wilberforce, and later on his son Samuel Wilberforce, Friedrich Schleiermacher, John Henry Newman, Alexis de Tocqueville, Soren Kierkegaard, Albert Schweitzer, G.K. Chesterton, Martin Buber, Karl Barth, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Abraham Herschel. What he shows with these, in every one of the cases I've just mentioned, with only one exception, and that was Kierkegaard, where he had some tension with his father, but that was later resolved, and even that tension had a profound impact on his writings until that was resolved. In every case, the father, there was a positive role model a positive development with the father. He talks about, though, that there can be extensions and qualifiers, in, such as substitute fathers, who substituted and provided that role model when their actual biological father was not present, and shows how that works as well. And then he talks about differences in men and women, and there are some differences there. I won't go into the whole thing. But at the very end of the book, he makes these conclusions here. Just a couple comments about that. He says, my ultimate interpretation of historically important atheists is that they are the product of their historical period, family psychology, that is, the defective father, intellectual intelligence and level of ambition, and last but far from least, their own free choice. He says this is not a determination, but it is a factor. What he's arguing, I think, is sustainable, is that there is a very real psychology of atheism, and I'd add something else myself. I would add the fact that Christianity isn't the kind of God you'd want to make up, to be perfectly frank with you. If you look at the God of the Bible, Old and New Testament, you have a God that is not exactly what people would like to find as comforting. He's holy, he's awesome, he is all-powerful, and he's all-knowing, and frankly, that would scare me to death if I really thought about that. That would be very traumatic. The realization that where can I escape from your spirit? Where can I hide from such overwhelming knowledge? It's too much for me. You see how actually the encounter with the numinous can be traumatic. And what's fascinating, by the way, to me is that there is in fact a known psychological mechanism that has three stages in it. The first one is that of trauma. And there are many people who become traumatized, and I can promise you, if you have a real numinous encounter with the awesome being that the scriptures describe as God, that can be something that's fairly overwhelming. And this can be a collective kind of a cultural trauma as well. By the way, the old thesis that religions evolve from basically a primitive animism to a kind of polytheism, then a henotheism, and then finally to some form of monotheism, and then an ethical monotheism. It does not wash well when you actually look at the history of religions. In fact, it turns out in Africa, in Aboriginal religion and so forth, in North America as well, that very many primitive tribes actually had a clear monotheistic foundation from the get-go. In fact, there's a primal monotheism that many of them historically then tried to escape from because of the very trauma that induced. And the idea is so far, so remote, so we would have sometimes the development of mediaries that would make it more accessible, which brings us to the next dimension, and trauma would lead to a kind of a repression, the repression of the conscious trauma, but it always leads in turn to substitutes. You cannot avoid that thing, so it bubbles up from the unconscious in the form of various substitutes. I might mention, by the way, that is exactly the psychology we see in Romans chapter 1. I won't go into detail, but if you study Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 32, you have a tremendous insight. Here it starts off by saying that Paul argues that we all know that God exists both from the evidence and the created order within this and also in creation without outside of us, verses 19 to 20. I'll let you kind of study this in your own. Verses 19 and 20. But that was something that was traumatic and in the face of each of us. Let me just read you the bit of the text just to show you what he's saying here. So if you looked at Romans chapter 1 and verses 19 to 20, there he says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. I'll start with verse 18. Against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. Then he says, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they're without excuse. And then he goes on to say next, though, in the face of this holy God, people chose to repress this knowledge and became foolish rather than wise. And they repressed this understanding and substituted gods of their own imaginations that were far more tame and a lot less traumatic. So he goes on to say, even though they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible birds, of man, of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies would be dishonored among them. So there seems to be a three-stage process where it leads to a spiritual, then to an intellectual darkness, and then to a moral display, and what surfaces from that. The point here is that he is saying here that after repressing their understanding of a true and holy God, they substitute the worship of facets of the creation, and thus it leads to this process that we've seen here. So I can argue then that actually we could turn the tables and say it could cut both ways. Now, in neither case will I claim that the psychology of theism or the psychology of atheism has any bearing on whether the thing is objectively true. It's just to say that what cuts one way cuts the other way. Does that make sense to you? So that's what I'm just saying there. So that argument needs to be seen for what it is. It's a two-edged sword. Now let me go on and add a couple of other words. Every one of us needs some kind of meaning in life. It is not wrong to seek significance and meaning. And certainly this is why every society that's ever lived, existed, has some forms of religious manifestations. It's not a matter of weakness. It's a matter of how you're going to seek meaning, not whether you will do so. Again, I said, faith is only as good as the object in which it's placed. Imagine that you're in Colorado in the mountains, and you're with a friend, and you discover that it's very close to dusk, and you're not going to make it to your lodge unless you go straight across this lake. It's in January, and you tell your friend, we got to walk across this lake so we can get there in time. Your friend balks and says, I'm afraid we'll crash through the ice. And you remind him, it's January. It's several feet thick at this time of the year. So you walk across, and he kind of crawls across on all fours all the way. But both get there. Although one had weaker faith than the other, they both had the same object. You see how that works? So they both get to the other side. Now it's June. It's later in the year. And the two are there, and the same thing happens again. And the other one, who was weaker in faith, says, well, let's go across the lake like we did before. And his friend reminds him, it's a little bit later now, and I doubt that it's a quarter of an inch thick. But he was undaunted and proceeds to go across and immediately crashes through the ice. In this case, he had a lot of faith, but it was a poor object. You see, so it goes both ways. It's not a question of how much faith you have, but whether it's putting it in the right object. And this is how it works. Faith's a universal experience. It's just the issue is, how good is it? Is it in the right object? So that's where I go here, and I say that we all seek meaning and purpose, but it's only as good as the object in which it's placed. This brings me to the issue of objectivity. And I argue that in our quest for legal and historical proof, we turn to the object and examine the person and work of Christ. That is the object about which Christianity is centered. And ultimately, the clearest critical historical event in association with the life of Jesus turns out to be the resurrection. And we spent an hour last week discussing that. I encourage people, as I've said before, to examine the primary historical records, those documents which purport to be eyewitness accounts that were written from the early on, and we'll talk about the reliability of the biblical documents when we get together, in fact, next time. So we're going to be looking at how accurate is the Bible issue. But even if we didn't buy them as being trustworthy in terms of being inspired, that's not the issue. You don't need to believe in their inspiration. If you just treated them as primary historical materials from that period of time and then use the same basic criteria of bibliographic, internal and external evidence that you would use with similar materials from that period of time, then you would you could develop a very powerful case for the resurrection, as we did before, and demonstrate that the tomb, that Jesus really was dead, that the tomb was empty, and that he appeared on many occasions to his disciples, in one case to over 500 at one particular time, for a period of 40 days until finally ascending to the Father, and that there were a variety of changes as well that were uniform in their life, and that as well, these people all died almost to a man, the disciples, that is to say, martyr's death. The only one that apparently did not die as a martyr was John, there was an account of him being boiled in oil, but the best accounts seem to be indicating that he was the one who survived the longest. The others willingly died for something that they were arguing they had borne witness to and had seen with their own eyes. I promise you, people do not willingly die for what they know is a fraud. They may be deluded, but if they know, and they'd be in a position to know, I promise you, and they had the opportunity to recant, but they didn't. So we talked about that last time. So I claim that Christianity has an objective foundation, and that when Jesus claims that I am the way and the truth and the life, that he is making certain objective truth claims, and if it's true, then everybody has a need for him, whether they know it or not. If Jesus is who he claims to be, then each person would have a need for him, whether they acknowledge it or not. I claim this, and we'll be seeing this in the weeks ahead, that Christ, according to Christ, he does not offer a crutch, but rather he offers a cure. It's a pretty big difference between the two. He gives us, through his own substitute, he offers us a complete restoration. And it's a complete cure which provides maximal abundance rather than a crutch that provides minimal assistance. So I say that believers shouldn't claim that Christianity is true because they experienced it. Rather, they could say that it's true and their experience confirms it because evidence can play a supportive role, but it's not the determinative role, if that makes sense to you. For example, I might have a compass that I use, and my thesis is that the sun rises each day in the same approximate location. I use my compass, and sure enough, it rises in the east pretty consistently. And I see that, but that doesn't create the sun doing that. It just is an evidential support that shows me. This is the way we do science. When you have a hypothesis, you begin to test that hypothesis. And if others can independently replicate the results of your experiment under the same controlled lab conditions, that becomes corroborative support. Remember when they had this cold fusion experiments for a while? Remember a few years ago they had that? And others tried to find have the same lab results and were unsuccessful in doing that, which made people question whether there was legitimacy to this. My point is that experience is used to corroborate truth. And so the ultimate issue then is that it would play a supportive role and that you would provide then a solid foundation of objectivity rather than the shifting sands of subjectivity. That's given me a couple extra minutes before we quit to see what questions you might have on anything we've said tonight or something in the previous weeks. Any thoughts? Yes, over here.
The name of the author that wrote this book.
The proper spelling of Vitz.
Oh, V-I-T-Z. Yeah. V-I-T-Z. Paul C. Vitz. He wrote a book called Psychology as Religion, The Cult of Self-Worship, a number of years ago. Not a popular book among some psychologists, but he himself is, as I say, he's professor of psychology at NYU and prominent thinker. He also wrote Sigmund Freud's Christian Unconscious. That was kind of an interesting. Anyway, yeah, interesting fellow. What other questions? Oh, yes.
Was it one of your theses on psychology?
Yes, my NYU dissertation when I was at NYU was not on this, though I met Vitz there, and that was on apologetic systems. But at the University of Oxford, that thing kept mutating on me. I was originally going to go there and do religious epistemology, so I was in the philosophy of religion, and I was submitting papers on the justification of religious belief from an epistemological standpoint. But then the thing kept mutating, because the dangerous thing is to have a thesis that doesn't work, You go closer, and then you discover I've gone down a dead end, and it's too late. So I kept on throwing my ideas. Here's where I'm going. What do you think? And I'd throw it at this great brain trust at the University of Oxford. And even though these other people weren't my profs, I figured I'd try them out. And they were all, every one of them, willing to at least examine. And they say, well, here's your problem with that. And they'd say, you're right. So then I'd redo the thing and go to someone else and, yes, yeah, you're right. And it kept mutating on me. Well, eventually it ended up to a development of theological and psychological accounts of human needs. Don't ask me how it iterated from the other thing, but I won't deal. But and it was a pretty big bite to chew off, and later on I said, how could you have done this? Such a stupid thing. You've just put yourself in, this is unbelievable, because I had six theologians, each of whom was voluminous. I had Augustine and Aquinas, and Soren Kierkegaard. I had Jonathan Edwards, Paul Tillich, and Karl Rahner. These are not easy reads, and they don't talk about human needs in one book. That's the problem. You have to scour their... And then I had eight psychologists, including Jung and Freud and Alfred Adler and Erik Erikson and Eric Fromm and Maslow and Otto Rank and... forgetting whom I'm, but the point is, Carl Rogers, I was a huge number of, and so I had to create these two models, a theological model and a psychological model. Then I did a convergence-divergence study to see what they have in common and where they diverge. And it turns out the divergence was consistently because of the different worldviews. In each of the eight psychologists, they all had a Judeo-Christian heritage which they had abandoned and had modified, and there were worldview assumptions that were implicit in their work but were not explicitly communicated, metaphysical and moral assumptions in their work. So I explicated those. And then I talked about, you know, kind of developed some conclusions from that. Yeah. If you want to read this, it's available. We got them at the Reflections Ministries office. If you want to, good bedtime reading. I can assure you, it's a great soporific. It'll put you to sleep for sure. Yes.
Do you know offhand what years Paul lived and died?
Paul the Apostle?
Yeah, I've thought about it a number of times.
Yeah. The best evidence we have is that Paul was almost exactly a contemporary of Jesus. And he may have been about 70 years old in that case when he died.